Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, March 18, 2014. President Salva Kiir expands his cabinet after reducing it last year.
We need an inclusive government where the other political parties can also participate. And you remember the other time it was because of the austerity measures that the government had to go lean.
And government forces and rebels clash in Upper Nile state capital.
They have been attacking, yeah. They have never stopped attacking us for the opposition. So it is the rebels that have been attacking us for the opposition for the last 2 weeks.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir issued an order yesterday creating 6 new ministries, increasing the number from 21 to 27 after cutting back the number of ministries less than a year ago. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Kampala.
The new ministries are Veterans Affairs, Trade, Industry and Investment, Labour, Tourism and Wildlife Conservation, Livestock and Fisheries, and finally Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management. Last August, President Kiir introduced a streamlined cabinet after firing every single minister, with the exception of Barnaba Marial Benjamin, who switched from being Information Minister to Minister of Foreign Affairs in late July. During that reshuffle, Mr. Kiir reduced the number of ministries from 29 to 21, saying he was responding to calls for a leaner government in order to save public funds. Foreign Affairs Ministry spokesman Mawien McCall Arik says now that the country is again exporting oil and austerity measures have been lifted, the government has the money to spend on additional ministries. And McCall says the new government will be more inclusive.
We need an inclusive government where the other political parties can also participate. And you remember the other time it was because of the austerity measures that the government had to go lean. But now things have changed and there is a need for an inclusive government, so that's why the government had to expand.
Last November, Finance Minister Agretisa Saboni said the government did not have enough money to pay many of its civil servants, as it was trying to pay back $5 billion in unfavorable loans it took on while oil production was shut down for more than a year. President Kiir has yet to appoint ministers who will head the 6 new ministries. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki.
Fighting broke out last night on the outskirts of Malakal town. The government and opposition groups traded accusations over who started shooting first. Aid agency officials say the fighting occurred within a few kilometers from a United Nations base. As Philip Aleu reports from Juba for VOA, tens of thousands of internally displaced people are staying at that UN compound.
Sudan People Liberation Army spokesperson Colonel Philip Aguirre says opposition forces have been attacking SPLA positions around Malakal for at least 2 weeks. He says last evening the SPLA came under attack 3 kilometers outside the town center.
They have been attacking, yeah. They have never stopped attacking SPLA position. SPLA have not attacked. So it is the rebels that have been attacking SPLA position for the last 2 weeks.
Anti-government military spokesperson Lul Rai Kwang disputes all of Aguirre's statement. He says the fighting only started 2 days ago when the SPLA attacked opposition forces.
The attacks in Malakal, it has been going on the last 48 hours. They have been trying to recapture Malakal and they have been attacking our forces, by the way. So it is true, but they have reversed. So there are ones who have been offensive, they have been on offensive. They are trying to recapture, maybe try to recapture Malakal before a third round of peace talks start here in Addis Ababa.
Neither side has reported casualty figures. Malakal has traded hands several times since fighting started in mid-December. In the last go-around about a month ago, anti-government forces retook Malakal, the capital of Upper Nile State. Oxfam spokesperson Grace Cahill says his tribe members in Upper Nile report yesterday fighting was near the UN base where they work, although the camp itself was not affected. Kail estimates at least 30,000 people are shattering at their base.
The fighting outside itself, not only within the MS compound. So our operations are within the IDP camp in the MS compound. Yesterday's fighting didn't disrupt our work, and we continue to work as normal today.
Kail says the fighting ended around 8 o'clock last night and has been quiet ever since. The government reported fighting in a nearby region last week. Aguirre says the SPLA refiled an attack on Ler in neighboring Unity State on Friday. He says two government soldiers were killed and 17 others injured. For BOA News, I'm Philippa Leu in Juba.
Japan has offered South Sudan $1.5 million in aid to support the ongoing peace talks in the Ethiopian capital, including $1 million to fund verification procedures of the cessation of hostility agreement. The Japanese ambassador to South Sudan, Takashi Kamasu, tells our reporter Philippa Leu that none of the money will be spent on buying arms.
Last week, we have announced the release of $1.5 million for peace process in South Sudan. And this is divided in two parts. And one is going to go to be utilized by the IGAD process, and the other part is by AUHIP. The first IGAD part is about $1 million. We are targeted for the allowances for the civilian members of the monitoring and verification mechanism, which is have been decided to be stationed at the peace agreement in January. Other $500,000 is allocated to the activities of the AU High-Level Implementation Panel by President Mubeki. This is going to facilitate the activities of this panel, coming dialogue between South Sudan and Sudan in bringing the peace.
So the money is going to be used by the team of IGAD and AUHIP, yes. Basically?
Yes, indeed. As I mentioned, for the first part for the IGAD, this is a major part of our contribution of $1.5 million.
How do you think that when you are funding the IGAD and AUHIP, that it will contribute to the building of peace in South Sudan?
I think it's, these contributions made through the IGAD and AU is in the regard of the fact that IGAD and AU are playing the major part in bringing about peace in South Sudan. Of course, we all know that the negotiation teams are ready to negotiate the restart negotiations from the 20th March in Addis, and we want to facilitate these activities. And since this conflict in South Sudan is not the at the first stage, it was not the tribal conflict, but the political dispute. So we want to have both the South Sudanese government and the rebel leaders to sit together and come up with a peaceful resolution, first and for all, to stop their violences against each other, and thus helping the peace to be prepared over South Sudan and South Sudanese people.
Are there some conditions that you are putting forward that they should be met by the government of South Sudan or another body that you are intending to release this money to, or is it just plain assistance?
Well, this is plain assistance. We are not putting too much conditions of the utilization of these funds, but we wanted to make sure that these funds are utilized for this proposed objects. Since this contribution comes from Japanese official development assistance, we cannot provide these ODA budget towards the military activities. That is why I have mentioned that the money is going to be supplied for the civilian activities of these panels.
In your own view, do you think that South Sudan can achieve peace, or what do you think will happen?
Of course, there are various views of what is going to happen to South Sudan, but all the international community, as well as Japan, is hoping that the peace will prevail once again in South Sudan, and that the South Sudanese people, as well as its government, will revert back to its own tracks of development and peace in this country.
That's Japanese Ambassador to South Sudan, Takashi Akamatsu, speaking with reporter Philippa Leu in Juba. The U.S. ambassador to South Sudan says her connection to the country and its people motivates her to continue working to find a lasting solution to the political crisis that broke out in mid-December. Susan Page says thousands of civilians who were caught up in the fighting have lost everything. In the final part of my interview with her, Ambassador Page expresses her personal feelings about the fighting in South Sudan.
Well, it's horrible. It's a real tragedy. You know, South Sudan, we knew, was going to have struggles. It's a country that is on the bottom of almost every single development indicator. So we knew it was going to be difficult. But it's, of course, painful to see the South Sudanese themselves fighting with each other and the massive destruction and killing that has taken place in the last almost 3 months now, where the violence has just really gotten out of hand and out of control. Thousands of people are dead, towns fully destroyed, villages destroyed. The little infrastructure that had been managed to be built after 2005, gone. Markets, people's livelihoods. So, of course, it's tragic, and no one can feel good about this. So we will continue to work with the people of South Sudan to try to make it possible for the internally displaced people, as well as those who have left the country out of fear, to be able to come back home, to offer suggestions. But ultimately, it's the will of the people of South Sudan to determine their future. And that's exactly what they fought for, is to determine for themselves their future.
Some critics within the region, especially critics of U.S. government, saying that you saw all the signs of what was happening, but a lot of people kept a distance, and they're acting now when everything is up in flames.
I disagree with that. We did see a lot of the signs of impending violence, given the things that were happening within the government, within civil society as well. But all we can do is advise, offer advice, but people are not obliged to take advice. And ultimately, the government has made decisions, and the people that are fighting the government have made decisions that are out of our control. And at the end of the day, the people of South Sudan have to want the kind of government, want the kind of society that they build themselves. And if they don't want it, we cannot want it more than they do.
That's Susan Page, U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan, speaking to me at the U.S. State Department here in Washington last week.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Dripping water taps, wastewater from washing, and rain can form pools of stagnant water where malaria-carrying mosquitoes and other parasites breed. But there are ways to minimize the risk. First, don't dispose of water in a low-lying area which doesn't drain naturally. If there's a stagnant pool near your living space, sweep the water aside. Then, in that spot, dig a hole at least a meter deep. Refill it with sand or gravel, which is porous and allows the water into the soil so a pool doesn't form there. To help protect you and your family from disease, do what you can to eliminate stagnant water.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Western Equatorial State officials accuse officials in Juba of illegally selling teak wood and pocketing the profits. That story is coming up.
For all the latest in-depth news and analysis on the events in South Sudan, tune in to Voice of America's South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. You can email us at southsudan@voanews.com. We're also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That is South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can the natural resources of your country be used to improve your life?
The natural resources of this country should be targeted at developing key projects that will benefit every citizen of this country.
Among the natural resources, we have forests, land, we have quarries. We have copper in Chilembe. So these sources, the forest can be used to make firewood, of which people sell and get money to pay school fees for their children.
These ones can be used to improve life by maybe developing the roads and also ensuring the, let's say, the security of the people.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today, we are talking about the positive effect of providing clean water. A new study indicates that providing students with safe drinking water can reduce absenteeism in schools in developing countries, but researchers are not sure why. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The study was done at 8 schools in Cambodia, where the attendance records of more than 3,500 students were checked. Half received the safe drinking water, which was treated with ultraviolet light and not chlorine. The other half did not. Paul Hunter is professor of health protection at the University of East Anglia.
This study was actually part of a slightly bigger study where we were looking at the impact of providing clean water on diarrheal disease in children in Cambodia. And as part of that, the charity that provides this water said, well, we also give water free to the schools. Is there any point in looking at whether it affects absenteeism in the school? And we looked and we found this quite strikingly strong association between providing drinking water and reduced absenteeism, at least during the dry season.
Hunter and his colleagues found that children without access to clean water were 2.5 times more likely to be absent.
This was certainly substantially more than I was expecting, to be honest.
Each school receiving the safe drinking water was given a 20-liter bottle per class each day. The cost is very low, about $1.40 per child per year, and is paid for by the charity 1001 Fountains. Hunter says there was no difference in absenteeism during the rainy season. There could be several reasons for this.
I visited in the rainy season, and it's not necessarily that easy to move around. So part of it might be that children actually couldn't get to school because of localized flooding. The other issue is, of course, children during the wet season may well be kept off school to help with the paddy fields. And it might well also be the fact that during the wet season, children don't get as thirsty and there's more water around.
Now, it may appear obvious that providing clean and safe drinking water would reduce absenteeism. Not so, says Hunter.
Initially, we did think it might be because of improved health, because of drinking less contaminated water, and that may well have contributed, but it probably wasn't the main driver.
The researchers looked at one school for clues.
In one of the schools, the contractor wasn't delivering as much water as he should have done, and we found in the weeks where he delivered a lot of water, absenteeism rates were low, and the weeks that he didn't deliver water, absenteeism rates were high. So that would be too quick if it was an infectious thing from drinking contaminated water.
So the reason remains a mystery, and more research is needed. Perhaps you could say the students simply had a thirst for knowledge.
Very well said. Yes. You could indeed, yes.
Professor Hunter adds that it's unclear whether the results from the Cambodia study can be applied directly to schools in sub-Saharan Africa. He describes education as one of the most important factors that enables children to fulfill their potential later in life and reduce poverty. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Western Equatorial state officials say they lose an estimated £1.5 million in revenue from illegal tick sales every year, and they blame national officials for the loss. They say officials in Juba are illegally removing the tick and exporting it without giving state officials the appropriate tax revenues. Mungume Devs Rakarinj has the story for VOA.
State Agriculture Minister West Yagule Kayuku Labadia says taxes from tick exports should be the main source of revenue for Western Equatoria, as thousands of hectares are logged each year. But he says last year, the state only received £100,000. Labadia called a news conference in Juba over the weekend to accuse national officials of using their power and influence illegally log and export teak.
We are seeing it. We are looking at the devastation. We are looking at the vehicles going, and we can't sit quiet. Otherwise, in an illegal sense, we would be considered as interfering in the national issues.
Labadia says the hardwood is popular in building houses and boats because it resists insect infestations. He says state officials are demanding that the illegal mining stop immediately and have told national officials that anyone who cuts down teak must pay fees to the state government. The National Undersecretary of Commerce Simon Nyang Anei says he doubts national officials are responsible. He says he has received no requests for licenses from officials to export the wood, which they need to move across the border. He says they have also received no reports from customs officials at the border that wood is being illegally shipped out of the country.
We are giving license for the somebody who is going to export officials. We are not receiving anyone who is going to export teak to write license to him.
Anei says if illegal logging is taking place, the state needs to launch a full police investigation before they blame national employees for illegal logging and revenue loss. Labadia says occasionally they arrest a person or apprehend a vehicle they believe is being used in connection with illegal logging. He acknowledges that in some of those cases, high-ranking authorities have intervened.
Sometimes they are arrested and the process are still going on. The owners come and complain here in Juba. I've got thousands of telephone calls for asking me to release some of those vehicles. I can see clearly they don't have any legitimate right for me to release them, but because the authority is coming from above, there's nothing I can do about it.
Labadia refused to identify any of those officials for fear of recrimination, but says he does want the illegal logging to stop so the state can earn revenue from legal logging. For VOA News, I am Gumedev Siruakarinj in Juba.
Human Rights Watch is praising a UN Human Rights Council statement that calls on Egypt and Sudan to investigate and persecute human traffickers. The council acted last Friday and also called on Egypt and Sudan to identify and persecute any security officials involved in trafficking of kidnapped Eritrean refugees. Gary Simpson is the senior refugee researcher for Human Rights Watch. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the group's concerns.
Eritrean refugees have been fleeing their country in huge numbers again since 2004. Large numbers, around 2,000 a month, are going into eastern Sudan, where since 2011, criminals, traffickers, have been kidnapping them and taking them into Egypt against their will, where they've been torturing them for tens of thousands of dollars in ransom.
Now, how much weight does the statement from the UN Human Rights Council actually have?
It's the first time that an international forum has addressed this issue. Until now, there have been a couple of press releases from the UN Refugee Agency, which, you know, studiously get ignored. There have been a lot of media coverage, both internationally and in Sudan and Egypt. But this is the first time an international UN institution has squarely addressed this issue. And so Egypt has responded confidentially, apparently, to this statement, admitting for the first time in writing that these crimes are taking place in Sinai, but denying that any security force collusion is involved.
What about Sudan? Any public acknowledgement of any activity in their area?
In January 2012, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, visited eastern Sudan to look into some of these problems, this mass kidnapping of Eritrean refugees as they cross from Eritrea into eastern Sudan. And since then, Sudan has acknowledged that these trafficking crimes are taking place. However, it's taken very few steps to prosecute traffickers, just a handful of cases, and has only prosecuted four law enforcement officials involved in these crimes. Given that we're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of people that have gone through these terrible situations, these numbers are laughable. And so we're hoping that this statement in the Human Rights Council will also put pressure on Sudan to increase its response to these terrible crimes.
Is there any action you would like to see the international community take aside from what happened at the UN Human Rights Council?
Well, what is key key from our perspective is that UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, does all it can to properly monitor the ongoing kidnapping of Eritrean refugees in and around the refugee camps in eastern Sudan, where UNHCR is active, and to report on how many people are being kidnapped and cases in which they hear of Sudanese police in particular who are working hand in hand with these traffickers, in some cases handing refugees over to traffickers for torture in Sudanese police stations. We think the UN has a very important role there to monitor and report on what's happening.
How many of these refugees who've been kidnapped actually are returned home?
The situation for Eritreans in Sinai, when they've been tortured, generally leads to them ending up in police stations. So they either they pay the ransom and are released, or they manage to escape the traffickers, and then they're intercepted by Egyptian security forces. And instead of being assisted and protected as trafficking victims, in some cases, people who have been horrendously tortured, including gang rape of women, amputation of fingers, terrible burning of limbs. Instead of assisting and protecting these people, they're prosecuted for unlawful presence in Egypt, detained in inhuman and degrading conditions, and then they're deported to Ethiopia.
Jerry Simpson is the senior refugee researcher for Human Rights Watch. He spoke to Joe DiCapua. Kenyan police have arrested two men they say were carrying explosives that were to be used in an attack. The arrest happened yesterday in the port city of Mombasa, where police say they found two homemade bombs and a mobile phone that could have been used as a detonator. They did not give specific location for a planned attack. Police say the men were of Somali origin, and Mombasa Police Chief Robert Kituri told Reuters they suspect the men are linked to the Islamist militant Al-Shabaab. Kenya sent forces into Somalia in 2011 to help the country fight the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab after it carried out a series of bombings and kidnappings in Kenya. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Crimea signed a treaty today to make the Black Sea Peninsula part of Russia, just 2 days after it voted to secede from Ukraine in a referendum the United States and the European Union declared illegal. Mr. Putin signed the document with the Prime Minister of Crimea's regional government, the Speaker of Crimea's parliament, and the mayor of the Crimean port city of Sevastopol, where Russia's Black Sea fleet is based. China says none of the Russian passenger or Chinese passengers aboard the missing Malaysian jetliner appear to have links to terrorism as the massive multinational search for the plane expands. Huang Huqing, Chinese ambassador to Malaysia, said today that the determination was made following background checks on all 154 of the plane's passengers. And finally, a suicide bomber has attacked a busy market in northern Afghanistan, killing at least 15 civilians. There are fears that violence will increase before the April 5th Afghan presidential elections. And that's a look at today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's all we prepared for you tonight. We leave you now with Emmanuel Camilo from Western Bahr El Ghazal singing in his native Balanda language.
Mori well not is in a birunga. Mori well not is in a gota. Mother well look at an editai banoman. Dakaba matinoni ninde. Mother well look at an editai banoman. Dakaba matinoni ninde.
Anida motambrum motarangono.
Then in a sonoti decada of tabano.
Anga so in meditizer.
My V. Nade no ping and out a bindi funo, but did you know? I took the kitty. Taleo no bandito, duta matani non donze, tia grindo no so, nita marconetan zombo, nita zei, nita zobo.
We have been listening to Emmanuel Camilo with that sweet melody, singing in his native Balanda language. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes and cars. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.